The global economy at the end of last week was brought to you by, if you remember, the phrase contagion. We start this week with a new one, dollar-denominated debt. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday today, August the 13th. Glad as always to have you along, everybody. For as complicated as the foreign exchange markets can be, and they can, what's going on with the Turkish lira, of which you have heard so much lately, is really pretty straight ahead. Domestic economic mismanagement in Turkey, new American sanctions, and debt. Lots and lots of foreign debt. With the lira having lost almost half of its value against the dollar so far this year, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going with why, for countries like Turkey, foreign debt is a gift that just keeps on taking.
For a while, a lot of money, dollars, euros, was flowing into Turkey. It was a big old international investment party.
There has been a fair amount of hot money foreign investment coming in on the construction sector in Turkey and the building boom.
Harry Broadman is at Johns Hopkins. The Turkish government has encouraged businesses to expand, which required borrowing from abroad.
About 90% of public and private sector debt in Turkey is denominated in foreign currencies.
Here's the problem. Because of the country's falling currency, that debt just got a lot more expensive. A Turkish business now effectively owes twice as much as it did at the beginning of the year. Lale Akiner is with Bank of New York Mellon's asset management business.
You are indebted in the U.S. dollar or euro, but obviously your revenue is in your local currency.
A Turkish cell phone company might now owe twice as much to a Spanish bank, but it can't double what it charges cell phone customers. This has some lenders worried about whether they will get paid back on time or at all.
If they can't get their money back, they will cut back on lending to other people.
Faribor Zgadar teaches at Penn State. Specifically, lenders may worry about loans to other countries that have kind of iffy economies.
So Argentina, Brazil, Portugal, Mexico, that are kind of, okay, we'll lend you money, but we're a little nervous about it, and you become very nervous about it.
Lending to these countries may suffer, but most are unlikely to experience full-blown currency crises like Turkey, in part because most economies aren't as mismanaged and fragile. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
So a logical question about Turkey, seeing as how, as Sabri said, they are in the category of most troubled emerging market economies, is now what do they do? Shebnem Kalemli Ozkan teaches economics at the University of Maryland. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So there is a long history in Turkey of President Erdogan and the central bank being at odds. As we just heard in that news spot, dollar-denominated debt is an issue. What are some things that the Turkish government could, if it so choose, do to make this situation a little bit better?
In these situations, the best line of action is somehow assuring the investors that Turkish situation is under control and economy is strong. They can definitely increase the interest rates. That will mean a higher return to foreign investors and will stop foreign investors from fleeing. They can start some conversations with IMF. The longer they wait, the harder it's going to get that these measures may not do anything.
Well, so here comes the put up or shut up question, though, right? President Erdogan has made it pretty clear he's not interested in doing any of these things. The central bank over there has made it clear it's not interested in doing anything if the president doesn't want them to. What would you say are the odds of any action actually being taken?
Well, Turkey has a floating exchange rate. There might be some room to wait and see how deep this is going to go, how panicky the markets are going to be. You know, tomorrow morning we might wake up and there might be calmer markets. We don't know. So I guess that's the approach they are taking right now. But of course, this is a trade-off, right?
Right.
It might work, you know, but my personal opinion is without anything, I don't think markets are going to calm down.
I'm
going
to guess you're speaking pretty regularly with friends and associates over in Turkey. What are they telling you about the last, 72 hours?
They are very worried. A lot of people are now afraid of a significant slowdown in the economy, which is possible at this point. I don't think a recession as deep as a Greek case or as deep as the Turkish case in 2001 is going to happen. But any significant slowdown, of course, will worry people. People have the right to be worried about this.
It's interesting you mentioned Greece because, man, that Greek debt crisis went on forever.
I mean, they're a little bit different. In Greece's case, there were a lot of the sovereign government debt that European banks were exposed to in much, much larger amounts, which of course ended up with a very deep recession.
Yeah.
I don't think this is going to be the case for Turkey, but of course, let's, you know, not forget that the Turkish economy also depends a lot on the foreign money. Now, in the short run, the currency is taking all the hit, and they have to do some immediate measure to stop that loss of value in the currency, and that can only be done by establishing credibility and stopping this confidence crisis.
Shebnem Kimlioskan, she's a professor of economics at the University of Maryland. Ma'am, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, so different topic. Here is a corporate headache for you. You spend $66 billion buying a company that you think is going to give you a strategic advantage in the global marketplace. And then that company you bought gets hit with a $289 million product liability verdict based on the performance of its key product. You would be the German conglomerate Bayer. The company you bought would be Monsanto, and the verdict was handed down on Friday. Oh, and your stock today dropped 10%, and you've lost $10 billion in market capitalization. Marketplace's Scott Tong explains what's going on with what used to be a seed company.
The court loss means Bayer is in for a litigious headache as it completes its acquisition of Monsanto, writes one stock analyst. Another estimates the full liability could be $5 billion based on past product liability suits. In this case, a California groundskeeper argued Monsanto knew Roundup caused cancer and failed to warn him. Carl Tobias teaches law at the University of Richmond.
I think it provides a roadmap for how plaintiff's counsel might proceed in the 4,000 other cases that have been filed, and may well encourage either plaintiff's lawyers or plaintiffs themselves to come forward if they think they could be successful.
He warns it is just one case, and it may take 10 or 15 more to gauge how strong plaintiff arguments are. The key is whether they can show a causal link to cancer, says analyst Christopher Perella at Bloomberg Intelligence.
And if they're able to do that, the outcome for Bayer is significantly worse. If they're not able to, then that significantly lowers the risk.
In a statement, Bayer said Roundup's main ingredient of glyphosate is safe and does not cause the cancer the plaintiff has. Monsanto stated it plans to appeal. Here's company VP Scott Partridge.
This single trial, it doesn't change the 40-plus years of safe use of glyphosate or the, you know, the 800 peer-reviewed medical scientific studies.
At the retail level, one UK chain store known as Homebase says it's now reviewing whether to keep selling products containing glyphosate. Another British chain, B&Q, is already doing that review. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was kind of meh with a Turkish accent. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. When the House gets back into session after Labor Day and in between electioneering, negotiators from both sides of the Capitol are going to try to reconcile their two competing versions of the Farm Bill. Yes, it's got assistance for farmers in it, crop insurance and price guarantees, but there's also a healthy chunk of the thing that's direct to consumers, helping low-income Americans buy food through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP it's called, sometimes food stamps. The House bill aims to require more people who get that aid to have jobs. The Senate version has fewer changes to the work requirement. But some states already do have programs in place meant to get recipients into the workforce, and Georgia is one of them. From WABE in Atlanta, Susanna Capilluto has more on that.
This is a brand new Toyota Highlander. Got smacked in the front.
Leanne Hatfield works at a body shop in Atlanta.
So I've taken the whole thing apart.
A few months ago, she was out of work and applied for food stamps.
And I went to the Department of Family and Children's Services. They have a program called the SNAPS Works program.
SNAP includes some federal money for job training. At the time, Hatfield had only worked off and on in low-wage service jobs.
And there was a wonderful lady there named Miss White, and she sent me to Goodwill for their training program, and I decided to get into the welding program because it's really good money, actually.
Hatfield says good money for her and her 11-year-old daughter is $30,000 a year. That's what she expects to make in this first job out of welding class. With experience, she hopes to make more. She took a free 13-week class through Goodwill Industries. The nonprofit offers training in 16 different occupations. Keith Parker is CEO of Goodwill of North Georgia. He says low-income people often earn very little unless they have the skills for work that pays higher wages.
we can help that person dramatically improve their financial situation, that's a win for us, the individual, the state, the federal government, all the above.
Georgia started the program as a pilot 2 years ago in three counties. It spends between $4,000 and $6,000 on every trainee like Hetfield. Goodwill donors pay half, and the federal government pays the rest. Katrina Young runs the state's SNAP work program. She says so far 8,000 SNAP recipients have gone through it, and it's now expanding statewide.
Your work requirement doesn't have to be something that's punitive. It could be something that actually connects you to a career.
Byron Hicks teaches welding to Goodwill trainees. His current class has five students. They stand at separate workstations using torches to mold pieces of metal. It's all practice for an upcoming welding certificate test.
They've never done this before. And I've got one over there right now I would put up against anybody whatsoever.
Hicks is clearly proud of his students, but he acknowledges that teaching groups of people who have no background in mechanics has its challenges.
Even down to the point where teaching them how to use a tape measure, having been able to read and measure is one of the most important things that industry is looking for nowadays.
State agencies that work with low-income people are closely watching the debate in Congress over work requirements for SNAP recipients. Russ Sykes is with the American Public Human Services Association. He says social service agencies know that work is the best way out of poverty. But even in a super strong economy, it's not that simple.
Let's be honest, in a lot of our programs, we have people who don't have as much labor market experience. And yes, jobs are going begging, and there's no doubt about that. But skilling people up among our population will take more time.
And money. Congress is looking to add $1 billion for training if it expands work requirements for 3 million more people. That's about $330 per person, and not enough under a program like Georgia's to get someone like Leanne Hetfield into a welding job. In Atlanta, I'm Susanna Capoluto for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They would drive you crazy sometimes because the windows would just rattle all the time.
Growing up next door to a missile test range. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. Dow Industrial's off 125 today, about a half percent, ended at 25,187. NASDAQ dropped 19 points, a quarter percent, 78.19. The S&P 500 slipped 11, four-tenths percent, 28.21. Banks faltered. Contagion, exposure, you know the drill. Wells Fargo gave back seven-tenths percent. Bank of America slid 2 2/10%. Citigroup off about 1.5%. Harley-Davidson down 4 3/10% today. That after President Trump backed the campaign to boycott the American motorcycle manufacturer. As you know, Harley plans to shift some of its production overseas to avoid retaliatory tariffs. Production, we should say, for overseas sales. VF Corporation, owner of Classic American Jeans, Lee and Wrangler, took off 3 6/10% today on news it intends to spin off those brands into a separate public company. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The elections in Zimbabwe at the end of July, the ones that were supposed to show the world that that country has moved beyond authoritarianism and is ready for international support and investment. Yeah, well, it hasn't. Six people were killed in protests after the candidate from the ruling party and the interim president, Emmerson Mnangagwa is his name. He won a razor-thin majority. That win is being challenged in court, though, which delayed the inauguration scheduled for yesterday. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson catches us up with the economic reality of Zimbabwe today.
Robert Mugabe has resigned as president of Zimbabwe.
November 2017, Zimbabwe's military removes President Robert Mugabe, who'd led the country since its independence in 1980.
The announcement was met with cheers by hundreds outside of parliament.
And covered by international media, CBS and NBC.
We are happy as citizens of Zimbabwe. Youth in Zimbabwe, we are happy.
In Mugabe's place, his former deputy, Emmerson Mnangagwa, takes charge. Not exactly a fresh start for the country, but he immediately starts trying to fix Zimbabwe's very broken economy. Between 2000 and 2008, the country's GDP fell by half, the sharpest contraction ever for a peacetime economy. Poverty rates soared to more than 70%. In the midst of hyperinflation in 2009, the country abandoned its own currency and adopted the U.S. dollar, which helped stabilize the economy temporarily, but it hit a second bout of hyperinflation in 2017 and is now desperately short on cash. Mnangagwa knows Zimbabwe can't tackle these problems on its own.
From now on, Zimbabwe is open for business. Yes, there will be political issues, but primarily it's economics, and trade.
That language is a big change from the Mugabe days. Mnangagwa does away with the requirement that companies be majority-owned by Zimbabweans. He promises to compensate white farmers for the land the government seized from them in the early 2000s. And in the run-up to the elections, all this talk starts to pique the interest of international investors.
And there have been many people scurrying around looking for opportunities in Zimbabwe.
Steve Hanke is a professor at Johns Hopkins University. He says the country used to be an agricultural powerhouse, so investors see lots of potential there. Hanke's actually mulling his own investment in Zimbabwe, building cold storage facilities for warehousing fruit.
We know there's a deficiency, and we know precisely what it is in Zimbabwe. Whether it is going to be economic and feasible to actually design and construct a cold storage facility and manage it, we don't know yet.
Hanke doesn't know if the promised economic reforms will materialize or what the money and banking system might look like. Will investors be able to borrow money? Will they be able to get their money out of the country when they want it back?
And that's all in a very big state of flux now, and I would say almost a bigger state of flux after the election.
The election that was supposed to reassure investors only raised more questions.
Just 2 days after the nation went peacefully to vote, there is bloodshed and chaos.
This from the UK's Channel 4.
And an election in which Zimbabwe dared to dream has instead brought back its worst nightmares.
The new Zimbabwe actually looks a lot like the old one, says James Hamill at the University of Leicester in the UK.
The mask of reform and reasonableness, all of that fell away when lethal force was used against unarmed demonstrators and there was a serious crackdown on opposition in the country. That was a return to the past.
Many potential investors had been holding back, treating the election as a test of the government's commitment to change. Takmor Chidede is a trade and investment researcher at the Trade Law Center in Cape Town, South Africa. He says the election didn't match the government's reform rhetoric.
It sends a negative message showing the investment community that the government is not prepared or is not ready or is not committed to respect the rule of law.
Instead of a green light, investors got something more like yellow to red. The message? Continue to wait and see. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
It seems almost, well, laughable is too strong, but once upon a time, fax machines were considered the height of telecommunications high tech. Now, of course, standalone fax machines generally sit gathering dust in many an office, but those big industrial scanner, printer, copier things that most of us work with, they also have, yes, built-in fax machines, and there's some new research out that says they can be very easily hacked. From WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris has more.
Researchers at Checkpoint Software Technologies found attackers could steal files through a company's network using just a phone line and a fax number. Dale Gardner with Gartner Research says this isn't surprising, since many older devices are linked to the internet.
So many of them were just really never designed with security in mind.
Michaela Menting is with ABI Research. She says older technology is like an unlocked gateway.
That can allow, you know, a malicious attacker into a brand new system with all kinds of digital, you know, bells and whistles and stuff. So people often ignore the old stuff, but they're like a stepping stone.
And it's not just fax machines, but also older technology like cranes on factory floors or tachometers in trucks now repurposed for the digital age. Martin Carlisle at Carnegie Mellon University says companies could always keep their fax machines on separate networks.
Your fax machine might then still be compromised, but you wouldn't be able to pivot from that into the rest of the network.
Or, as Yaniv Balmas, who worked on the Checkpoint report, says,
you can stop using fax because it's 2018.
Some industries choose to use fax machines. Jonathan Cooper-Smith wrote Faxed, The Rise and Fall of the Fax Machine. He says the medical industry, for example, is still very paper-oriented.
Even though there's a big move towards electronic records, it has a lot of the same problems that email had back in the 1980s, 1990s, including incompatible systems.
Another reason the medical industry relies on fax machines? It's more secure than email. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
President Trump signed the National Defense Authorization Act today, technically the John S. McCain National Defense Authorization Act, $700-some-odd billion worth of Pentagon spending for the coming fiscal year. Keeping this country and its military at war and prepared for war brings with it economic realities, one of which is that all of that Pentagon spending means jobs, a lot of jobs for a lot of people, Karen Piper's parents included. There were weapons developers at the China Lake Naval Weapons Station up in the Mojave Desert north of Los Angeles. Karen Piper's got a new book out about growing up there. It's called A Girl's Guide to Missiles. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me, would you, first of all, what China Lake is like? Because most people here in this program probably, A, don't know where it is, and B, have no clue about what it's all about.
Well, it's in the Mojave Desert in California at the base of the Sierras, and it's all run by the military. So it's about the size of Rhode Island. They do weapons tests out there and evaluate missiles.
How did you wind up growing up there?
Basically because my dad got laid off at Boeing in the 1970s when there were a whole bunch of layoffs. And that was the job he got, was out there in China Lake making missiles. So that's, we all packed up the car and headed out there without really knowing what we were getting into.
And what you were getting into is the subject pretty much of this book. It occurred to me as I was reading this that really, because China Lake is so remote and so big and so intentionally isolated, right? What you have is a company town where everybody is sort of in the same business, right?
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's a company town, but it's a town run by the U.S. government. I mean, I remember when I moved to Riverside, I thought it was odd that they didn't have low-flying jets and sonic booms all the time. Because that's just like, and they would drive you crazy sometimes because the windows would just rattle all the time. But you got used to it.
And everybody's got security clearances and it's all classified. And so probably people aren't talking much about it when they run to the general store or to get a cup of coffee.
If I asked my mom and dad what they did for work, they just wouldn't answer over the dinner table. So, you know, I knew they worked on missiles because everybody in the town works on missiles. But nobody really explained to me as a kid what it was all about. And it was a little bit confusing.
One of the things that wound up happening because China Lake is out there in the middle of nowhere is that they kind of had to hire the wives of the men who had actually gotten the jobs. Talk about that for a minute. I mean, this is, you know, we're talking about your mom here.
I looked into the history of women on the base and I found out that the base had to work hard to get women there because it was a seedy kind of environment in the beginning. So in the newspaper, I saw an ad. It said housewife to draftsman in 12 weeks. Hmm. And they were trying to promote women to come and just learn how to work with weapons on the base. And so that's what my mom did. She went in and kind of worked her way up until she was a computer scientist.
Did anybody ever talk about the fact that, you know, just for instance, the Reagan defense buildup of those years was really good for business?
Yes. I do remember, you know, there were times when people were really proud when our weapons were used in war without so much thinking about what the war actually was about. People were just doing their jobs.
It's a book called The Girl's Guide to Missiles. It's a family story and also a little bit about the military industry in this country. Karen Piper wrote it. Karen, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in which Elon Musk lets us in on exactly what funding secured meant. Remember, that was the tagline of his cryptic tweet last week saying he was going to take Tesla private at $420 a share. Musk said today, oh, it's the Saudi Arabian Sovereign Wealth Fund that he's been talking to, and that while there is not a signed deal, He left the recent meeting thinking, and this is a quote, "It was just a matter of getting the process moving." The markets are less than moved, with $420 a share being dangled out there. Tesla closed today at $356 a pop. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials off about a half percent today, 125 points. S&P 500 down 19, about a quarter percent. NASDAQ down 0.4%, 11 points. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Phoebe Underman. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.